way from words like crone or witch. At the onset of old age, boomers will do what they have done with every earlier step of the aging process. They will resist it for a while, then dabble in it, and ultimately glorify it. Boomers will establish elegant new insignia of advanced age, flaunting, not avoiding, the natural imprints of time. Rather than trying to impress the young with GI-style energy or silent-style cool, old boomers will do so with a zen-like serenity, a heightened consciousness of time. Slow talking, walking, and driving will become badges of contemplation, not decline. The ideal of advanced age will not be the active and leisured GI, or the empathic and expert silent, but rather an elder who thinks deeply, recalling Emerson's view that, as we grow old, the beauty steals inward. The very word retirement will acquire a new negative meaning, connoting selfish consumption and cultural irrelevance. The elder goal will not be to retire, but to replenish or reflect or pray. The very concept of any retirement will fade, as boomers pursue new late-life careers, often in high-prestige but low or non-paying emeritus positions. Aging boomers will be drawn to the classic. Their late-life cultural questing will not evoke juvenescence, as it did in the Awakening era, but rather a preservation of values that will increasingly seem old to others. Boomers will rail against pop culture detritus left over from the unraveling. Violent films, shopping malls, convenience stores, packaged throwaways. Under their stewardship, Hollywood will establish standards of taste while making definitive films of great literature and biography. While boomer elders will still make heavy demands of the young, the nature of those demands will differ greatly from those imposed by today's elders. Where the Awakening-era GIs burdened the young fiscally, crisis-era boomers will burden the young culturally. They will reverse the coin of elderhood from what they will remember of the Awakening. Where GI elders once obtained secular reward in return for ceding moral authority, boomers will seek the reverse. Accordingly, grandchildren will not look to them for financial advice, as per GI seniors, or emotional support, as per the silent seniors, but rather for guidance in the realm of ideals and values. To young eyes, old boomers will appear highly eccentric. What boomers feel as inner warmth will feel cold to others, and what they see as ethical perfectionism will sometimes strike others as hypocrisy. In the fourth turning, boomers are likely to occupy the vortex of a downward economic spiral. This will happen partly because of their numbers, but mainly because of their location in history and collective persona. There will be a payback for the boomer tendency to graze on a problem until they finally decide to focus fully, at which point their sudden discovery becomes as much the issue as the original problem. Sooner or later, the truth will dawn on boomers that the money simply won't be there to support their accustomed consumption habits in old age. Neither they nor their nation will have saved enough. From this sudden realization could issue the endgame of boomer lifelong consumption and saving habits, the Great Devaluation. At long last, aging boomers will focus on the hard fact that a newly endangered America truly cannot, and younger generations will not, make boomer old age subsidies its top public priority. This realization will render boomers jittery about preserving the remaining assets. Some unforeseeable happenstance could spark a precipitous market sell-off, as old investors will want to liquidate their equities to a shrinking universe of buyers. The main domestic buyers would be 13ers, who will have lower incomes and far fewer assets than boomers, and who will be of no mind to take risks with wobbling markets. Foreigners will be hesitant to acquire more U.S. assets in a time of pending fiscal crisis, especially with so many of their own societies facing similar demographic problems. A brief but precipitous panic will ensue. Years of savings could vanish in a matter of days or hours. The Great Devaluation is likely to hit boomers just as their first cohorts are reaching the official ages of retirement, long before Social Security is now projected to go into official bankruptcy. Indeed, the panic could be triggered in part by the crystallizing financial anxieties of leading-edge boomers. The flashpoint may well occur when the new elder mindset of the 1943 Victory Baby cohort combines with the new demographic realities of the large 1946 Baby Boom cohort to reach a critical mass. This is likely to occur a few years before or after 2005, probably between 2002, when the 1943 cohort reaches the IRA distribution age of 59.5, and 2008, when the 1946 cohort reaches the initial Social Security eligibility age of 62, the age at which over two-thirds of Americans now start receiving benefits. Unlike their predecessors, boomers will consider their old age finances to be more a private than public concern. For GIs, Social Security has been a generational bond running through government, its monthly checks a standard-issue badge of senior citizen equality. For the silent, Social Security will have been a play-by-the-rules annuity, offering a mixture of delight for sneaking through just in time and guilt for burdening their kids. For boomers, Social Security will be the object of fatalism and sarcasm. Some will get it, and some won't. The typical boomer will live on bits and pieces of SEP IRAs, KEOs, 401ks, federal benefits, and assorted corporate pension scraps that will vary enormously from person to person. For many, it will add up to a lot. For many others, nearly nothing. When the market hits bottom, millions of boomers will find themselves at the brink of old age with far smaller nest eggs than they ever expected. They will immediately have to make do with steeply diminished material consumption. Many will have no choice but to live communally or with their adult children, while groping for ways to preserve a meaningful life on very little money. Following the Great Devaluation, boomers will find new ethical purpose in low consumption because, with America in crisis, they will have no other choice. To maintain GI-style elder dependence on the young, boomers would have to wage political war on their coming-of-age millennial children. It is a war they will not wage, and would not win if they did. Instead of political battles with other generations, boomers will engage in moral battles among themselves. Those who retain assets will accuse those who don't of irresponsibility and lack of thrift. Those who don't have assets will accuse those who do of having battened off the corrupt old order. Younger generations will agree with both accusations. In the end, the next New Deal will find all boomers, rich and poor, paying a price. Many who spend a lifetime paying steep Social Security and Medicare taxes will be substantially excluded from benefits by an affluence test. Those who still qualify for public aid will receive a much worse deal than their GI parents did. The debate will rip apart whatever remains of the old senior citizen lobby built by GIs back in the Awakening. The AARP will survive only by reinventing itself as a council of elders committed to advancing the needs of posterity. Modern Maturity magazine will have to shift its style from silent hip to boomer classic, and change its title to refer to aging in more traditional and less euphemistic terms. The next New Deal will render the boomers' old-age healthcare subsidies a tightly regulated social decision, crafting necessity into virtue. Boomers will deem the postponement of death as not a public entitlement. Many elders will eschew high-tech hospital care for homeopathy, minimalist self-care, and the mind-body techniques Deepak Chopra calls quantum healing. Despite the boomers' larger numbers and longer lifespans and the costly end-of-life technologies that medicine might then offer, the share of fourth-turning national income that will be spent on federally subsidized elder health care will fall below what it was in the unraveling. Old boomers will construct a new social ethic of decline and death, much like they did in youth with sex and procreation. Where their youthful ethos hinged on self-indulgence, their elder ethos will hinge on self-denial. Old age will be seen as a time of transition and preparation for dying. With the same psychic energy with which they once probed Eros, boomers will now explore Thanatos. As they fill the upper age brackets, boomers will believe themselves to be elders who, in the words of anthropologist Joan Halifax, function like old cobblers and dressmakers, sewing us back into the fabric of creation. They will feel a new transformative dimension of time, enabling them to craft myths and models that can re-sacralize the national community, heal its dysfunctions, and grant moral authority for the next golden age. The very otherworldliness that boomers will regard so highly in themselves will strike younger generations as evidence of incompetence. Their contempt for this world will strike younger people as dangerous. Yet regardless of what you think of these old messengers, they will respect their message and march to their banner. Thus will the Grey Champion ride once more. 8 or 9 decades after his last appearance, America will be visited by the figure of an ancient man, combining the leader and saint to show the spirit of their sires. Whence will come the Grey Champion? Picture the boomer overclass of the Unraveling, aged another 20 years. Picture Bill Bennett's consequence and confrontation missives, Al Gore predicting an environmental cataclysm, James Webb's summoning a ruthless and overpowering retaliation against foreign enemies, James Fallows rooting for a 7.0 magnitude diplo-economic shock, Apocalypse Darman and Default Newt with their budget train wrecks, Earth First saboteurs willing to sacrifice other people's lives to save trees, and Army of God anti-abortionists summoning the terminally ill to use your final months to torch clinics. Picture all these boomers, older and harsher, uncalmed by anyone more senior, feeling their last full measure of strength, sensing their pending mortality, mounting their final crusade, all at a time of maximum public peril. The full dimension of the boomer persona will only emerge when today's better-known 1940s birth cohorts, whose youth was marked by relatively few social pathologies, are joined in public life by the tougher-willed, more evangelical 1950s cohorts, whose youth was marked by many more pathologies. That is the mix that will beget this generation's elder priest-warrior persona, vindicating the early Unraveling era warning of Peter Collier and David Horowitz that boomers are a destructive generation whose work is not over yet. As the crisis deepens, boomers will confront the end result of their lifelong absorption with values. The habitual boomer tendency to enunciate unyielding principles will now carry the duty of enforcement. In domestic matters, old boomers will recast the old arguments of the culture war into a new context of community needs. In foreign matters, they will narrowly define the acceptable behavior of other nations, and broadly define the appropriate use of American arms. The same boomers who in youth chanted, "Hell no, we won't go," will emerge as America's most martial elder generation in living memory. Whatever the elements of crisis, old boomer leaders will up the moral ante beyond the point of possible retreat or compromise. The same boomers who once chanted, "Ho, ho, Ho Chi Minh, the NLF is gonna win," will demand not just an enemy's defeat, but its utter destruction. They will risk enormous pain and consequence to command youth to fight and die in ways they themselves would never have tolerated in their own youth. They will believe, as did Cicero, that this moment in history assigns young men for action, old men for counsel. As the crisis resolves, elder boomers will not have the last word, but the deep word. If they triumph, they will collectively deserve the eulogy Winston Churchill offered to Franklin Roosevelt, to die an enviable death. If they fail, their misdeeds will cast a dark shadow over the entire 21st century, perhaps beyond. What about 13ers? The onset of the fourth turning will find them entering midlife still the targets of elder criticism, the only change being that America's troubled age bracket will then be perceived as more 40-ish than 20-ish. They will carry the reputation for having come of age at a time when good manners and civic habits were not emphasized in homes and schools. With their arrival, midlife will lose moral authority and gain toughness. Their culture will be a hodgepodge of unblending styles and polyethnic currents that will reflect the centrifugal impulse from which many Americans, including 13ers, will now be eager to escape. In the economy, 13 or 40-year-olds will be faring significantly worse than boomers did at a like age back in the mid-1980s. They will fan out across an unusually wide range of money and career outcomes. A few will be wildly successful. A larger number will be destitute, while most will be losing ground but doing tolerably. The crisis era's image of a middle-aged worker will be a modest-wage job hopper who retains the flexibility to change life directions at a snap. The prototype midlife success story will be the entrepreneur who excels at cunning, flexibility, and high-tech ingenuity. The prototype failure will be the ruined gambler, broke but still trying. As they confront their money problems amid a mood of deepening crisis, Thirteeners will take pride in their ability to have a life and wall off their families from financial woes. Their divorce rate will be well below both that of midlife silent and boomers. They will clamp down on children. In exchange for financial help, many will invite their better-off parents to live with them. The 13er mindset will be hard-boiled and avuncular, the risk-taking now mellowed by a crisis-era need for security. Middle-aged people will mentor youth movements, lend stylishness to hard times, and add nuts-and-bolts workmanship to the resolute new mood. They will be begrudgingly respected for their proficiency in multimedia and various untutored skills, to which old boomers will be blind and young millennials dismissive. Throughout the economy, 13ers will be associated with risk and dirty jobs. They will seek workable outcomes far more than inner truths. As the crisis deepens, 13ers will feel little stake in the old order, little sense that their names and signatures are on the social contract. They will never have known a time when America felt good about itself, when its civic and cultural life didn't seem to be decaying. From childhood into midlife, they will have always sensed that the nation's core institutions mainly served the interests of people other than themselves. The we're-not-worthy 13er streak of weak collective esteem will define and enhance their new civic role. Where the boomers' unraveling-era narcissism interfered with America's ability to exact even minor sacrifice for the public good, the 13ers' ironic self-deprecation will render their claims unusually selfless. They will vote against their own short-term interests if persuaded that the community's long-term survival requires it. Disregarding motive and ideology, they will simply ask if public programs get results that are worth the money. As elder benefits hit the fiscal wall, boomers and 13ers will, like siblings, half remember and half forget how they behaved toward each other in earlier decades. There will be some talk of ethno-generational war, as non-Anglo 13ers attack boomer benefits as what former Social Security Commissioner Dorcas Hardy has called a mechanism by which the government robs their children of a better future in order to support a group of elderly white people. Led by ethnic populists, 13ers will strike a hard bargain with elders they will collectively perceive as lifelong hypocrites with a weak claim on the public purse. As the crisis rages on, the era's stark new communitarianism will require 13ers to rivet new grids in place. Having grown up in a time when walls were being dismantled, families dissolved, and loyalties discarded, 13er power brokers will reconstruct the social barriers that produce civic order. They will connive first to get the people behind them, next to bribe or threaten people into doing what's needed, and then to solidify those arrangements into something that works. Their hands strengthened by the demands of crisis, 13ers will sweep aside procedural legalisms and promises legislated by old regimes, much to the anguish of the octogenarian silent. To critics, the new style of 13er urban leadership will appear unlearned, poorly rooted in values, even corrupt, but it will work. In this environment, 13ers could emerge as the leaders of a crisis-era populism based on the notion of taking raw action now and justifying it later. A charismatic anti-intellectual demagogue could convert the ad slogans of the unraveling into the political slogans of the fourth. No excuses. Why ask why? Just do it. Start with a winner-take-all ethos that believes in action for action's sake, exalts strength, elevates the impulse, and holds weakness and compassion in contempt. Add class desperation, anti-rationalism, and perceptions of national decline. The product, at its most extreme, could be a new American fascism. The core feature of the 13ers' midlife will be the crisis itself. Though 13ers will have little ability to influence the elements and timing of the boomer-propelled crisis, they will provide the on-site tacticians and behind-the-scenes bosses whose decisions will determine its day-to-day course. Middle-aged 13ers will be the only ones capable of deflecting the more dangerous boomer tendencies. The boomers won't check themselves, nor will millennials. So the task will fall to 13ers to force the boomer priest warriors to give it a rest when the fervor gets too deep, to get real when the sacrifices outweigh the future reward. A 13er may indeed be the intrepid statesman, general, or presidential advisor who prevents some righteous old Aquarian from loosing the fateful lightning and turning the world's lights out. At or just after the crisis climax, 13ers will supplant boomers in national leadership. History warns that they could quickly find themselves playing real-world Sim City or war games, faced with quick triage choices about who and what to sacrifice and when and how. Whatever they do, they will get more than their share of the blame and less than their share of the credit. As the crisis resolves, the society will be fully in 13er hands. If all ends well, their security-minded leadership will usher the society away from urgent crusades and into the next high. If not, 13ers will be left with no choice but to yank younger generations by the collar, appraise what's left of their society, and start anew. In the next crisis, young adult millennials will prove false the supposition, born of the recent awakening and unraveling eras, that youth is ever the age for rebellion, alienation, or cynicism. Rather than argue with elders, millennials will seek out advice about the ought-to-dos of life from old boomers and about the want-to-dos of life from 13ers. But their style will be distinct from either generation. From the youth perspective, most boomers will seem too unworldly, and most 13ers too undisciplined to be emulated. New pop culture trends will be big, bland, and friendly. In film, young stars will be linked with positive themes, display more modesty in sex and language, and link new civic purpose to screen violence. In sports, players will become more coachable, more loyal to team and fans, and less drawn to trash talk, in-your-face slam dunks, and end-zone taunts. In pop music, millennials will resurrect the old ritual of happy group singing, from old campfire favorites to new tunes with simple melodies and upbeat lyrics. Whether in film, sports, or music, the first millennial celebrities will win praise as good role models for children. Every youth domain they touch will become more mannerly, civic-spirited, and emotionally placid. In college, millennials will lead a renaissance in student decorum and appearance, as profanity becomes as out of date as the backwards cap. On urban streets, young adults will begin sensing that their best path to prosperity is to follow their peers, not their families. In technology, they will carve out fresh concepts of public space by designing fewer and more centralized paths of communication, and by using information to empower groups rather than individuals. In social movements, they will initially seem pacifist, hard to ruffle, their civic power as yet untapped. The media will miss no opportunity to celebrate the good deeds they do. On the job, millennials will be seekers of order and harmony. They will delight employers with their skills, work habits, and institutional loyalties. They will have a knack for organization and hierarchy, more than creative entrepreneurship. Young workers will revitalize trade unions and treat co-workers as partners more than rivals. The millennials' entry into the workforce, combined with the boomers' exit, will produce a sudden surge in productivity. The great devaluation may occur right around the time millennials fill the 20s age bracket, just as they are emerging as a truly national generation, the pride of their elders. Whatever their new economic hardships, and they could be severe, millennials will not rebel, but will instead mobilize for public purpose. Older people will be anguished to see these good kids suffer for the mistakes of others. Boomers and 13ers will together urgently resist the prospect that a second consecutive generation might be denied access to the American dream. No matter how shattered the economy, no matter how fiscally stretched the government, places will be found for the rising generation. Government will play an important role as people of all ages jointly resolve to remove any barrier to a bright millennial future. When young adults encounter crisis-era politicians, or officials who oppose their concept of progress and cling to the old regime, they will not feel alienated or tune out 13er style. Instead, they will get busy working to defeat or overcome them. Their success will lead some older critics to perceive real danger in the political energy of a rising generation perceived as capable but naive. This youthful hunger for social discipline and centralized authority could take an ominous turn in the 2010s. Millennial youth brigades could lend mass to dangerous demagogues. The risk of class warfare will be especially grave if the 20% of millennials who were poor as children, 50% in inner cities, come of age seeing their peer-bonded paths to generational progress blocked by elder inertia. Wherever their politics lead, millennials will become identified with a new American mainstream, a fledgling middle class just waiting to assert itself. Just as the unraveling's political agenda centered around children, the agenda of the next New Deal will center around young adults. In exchange, old boomers will impose a new duty of compulsory service, notwithstanding their own youthful draft resistance. Millennials will not oppose this because they will see it as a path to public achievement. If inducted to fight a war, millennials will cast aside any earlier pacifism and march to duty. They will not be averse to militarized mass violence, just to uncontrolled personal violence, quite the opposite of boomer youths back in the awakening. National leaders will not hesitate to mobilize and deploy them in huge armies. Where boomer youths once screamed against duty and discipline, boomer elders will demand and receive both from millennial troops. Near the climax of crisis, the full power of this rising generation will assert itself, providing their society with a highly effective instrument for imposing order on an unruly world. As a crisis-era president commits the society to clear a path for a bright future, the political juggernaut of millennial youth will stand squarely with their beloved commander-in-chief. This generation of young heroes will follow wherever the great champion leads, whether to triumph or disaster. Come the fourth turning, a new silent generation will enter childhood. At this time, the rules a child must follow will begin outlasting the original reasons for those rules. Picture high-rise children still barricaded behind walls in a time of reduced crime on the streets below. Picture compulsory kindergarten uniforms in a time of wholesome new trends in young adult fashion. Picture a vigorous police presence in a time of generally compliant teenagers. What in the unraveling felt like sensible protections will now, in the crisis, reach a state of stifling suffocation at the hands of parents and governments alike. The babies of the OOs will be America's next artist archetype, the new silent generation. Their link to crisis will be as the vulnerable seeds of society's future that must be saved while the emergency is overcome and the enemy defeated. These little children will be the crisis era's fearful watchers, tiny helpers, and if all goes well, lucky inheritors. Tethered close to home, they will do helpful little deeds like recycling, keyboarding, or tending to elders, the circa 2020 equivalents of planting World War II victory gardens. The new silent will look upon adults as competent and in control. Crisp rights and wrongs will be a common adult message, unquestioning compliance the expected response. New silent kids will not be encouraged to take chances or do things on their own. Naivete and sweet innocence will be presumed to flow from those of tender age. In a reverse from the unraveling, deviancy will be redefined upwards. Youth, sex, abortion, and substance abuse will remain at low levels. Parental divorce will be restigmatized, and public talk about private matters will be newly taboo in the media. Unlike today, the bulk of the family disruptions will be involuntary, the result not of personal choice or dysfunction, but of crisis-era forces utterly beyond the family's control. Child welfare will be a settled priority, no longer anyone's crusade. Protective nurture will be on autopilot. Few adults will dispute that children must be taught community norms, often by rote. Children who fall below standards will be warned that the community has ways of remembering that a young person's reputation can be easy to harm, but hard to repair. Good child behavior, academics, and civic deeds will win few kudos because all that will simply be expected. The new silent will be treated this way because that will be how middle-aged 13ers will prefer it, and they will be America's dominant crisis-era nurturers of children. As parents, teachers, and community leaders, 13ers will look back upon their awakening-era childhoods as chaotic, hurried, insecure, and underprotected. While 13ers take pride in the firmer, more reliable family life they will establish, new silent kids will find it a smothering overcorrection. Later in life, they will recall their crisis-era child's world as having been oversimple, overslowed, overprotected, and too grounded in moral cement. Like history's other inheritor or post-heroic generations, the new Silent will endure constant reminders of what great sacrifices are being made on their behalf. As the crisis rolls on towards its resolution, they will cope with anxiety, fear, and powerlessness. For the rest of their lives, they will never forget these feelings. If the crisis catalyst comes on schedule, the climax will be due around 2020, the resolution around 2026. What will America be like as it exits the fourth turning? History offers no guarantees. Obviously, things could go horribly wrong. The possibilities ranging from a nuclear exchange to incurable plagues, from terrorist anarchy to high-tech dictatorship. We should not assume that Providence will always exempt our nation from the irreversible tragedies that have overtaken so many others, not just temporary hardship, but debasement and total ruin. Since Vietnam, many Americans suppose they know what it means to lose a war. Losing in the next fourth turning, however, would mean something incomparably worse. It would mean a lasting defeat from which our national innocence, and perhaps even our nation, might never recover. As many Americans know from their own ancestral backgrounds, history provides numerous examples of societies that have been wiped off the map, ground into submission, or beaten so badly they revert to barbarism. The outcome of the next fourth turning will determine the enduring reputation of the unraveling era in which we now live. If America plunges into an era of depression or violence, which by then has not lifted, we will likely look back on the 90s as the decades when we valued all the wrong things and made all the wrong choices. If the fourth turning goes well, however, memories of the unraveling will be laced with nostalgic fun. More important, a good ending will probably mean that America has taken individual freedoms that now seem socially corrosive and embedded them constructively in a new social order. What present-day tensions will the next fourth turning resolve? Most likely, they will be culture wars updates of the perennial struggle between the individual and the community, with new labels dating back to our recent consciousness revolution. This time, the individual ideals go under the rubric of choice, from marketplace choice to lifestyle choice, from choice about manners, appearance, or association, to the choice of entertainment and expression. The social ideals go under the rubric of community, and point to where all of the various choices must be curtailed if we wish to preserve strong families, secure borders, rising living standards, a healthy environment, and all the other building blocks of a sustainable civilization. If the next fourth turning concludes successfully, some great leader may be credited with saving individual empowerment by making it compatible with higher ideals of social responsibility. Much as FDR was credited with saving capitalism while forging the New Deal, and Lincoln with extending liberty while preserving the Union. However sober we must be about the dark possibilities of crisis, the record of prior fourth turnings gives cause for optimism. With five of the past six crises, it is hard to imagine more uplifting finales. Even after the Civil War, the American faith in progress returned with new robustness. As a people, we have always done best when challenged. The new world still stands as a beacon of hope and virtue for the old, and we have every reason to believe this can continue. By the mid-2020s, the generational archetypes will be ready for something new. The fourth turning will be ready to expire when each generation begins entering a new phase of life. First, the elder prophets, still leading the culture while vacating institutions, will now worry about a society whose new materialism they find alien. Once the great champion recedes yet again into history, younger people may still listen but will no longer heed the old moral imperatives, having wearied of the cost of principle. If the crisis ends badly, very old boomers could be truly despised. If it ends well, they will bask in grand encomia in a new golden era that will resemble the very kind of ordered society in which they were raised as children. Many will seclude themselves deep in the woods or in dusty libraries, exploring ways to bequeath to posterity their final states of consciousness. Like the four old men, Holmes, Longfellow, Whittier, and Lowell, whose portraits graced countless Gilded-era schoolrooms, the grim eyes of old boomer titans will stare down on yet another child generation. Recalling what old Susan B. Anthony did for the turn-of-the-century women's movement, a few boomer antiques will exhort the young to rise against the post-crisis order and launch another 1960s-style awakening. Around the year 2050, to the delight of a few lingering ex-flower children straddling age 100, Pepperland will finally recur. Second, the midlife nomads, sensing that the old crusades have run their course, will now plan to fortify community discipline and narrow the scope of personal choice. Come the next high, at long last freed of the weight of boomers, 13ers will be America's new old fogies, widely perceived as old-fashioned, the only generation still rooted in the mostly forgotten pre-crisis past. If the crisis ends badly, they might provide the demagogues, authoritarians, even the tribal warlords who try to pick up the pieces. If the crisis goes well, its 13er generals may well become the U.S. presidents of the next high. Crusty conservatives, they will warn younger generations of the danger of rushing too swiftly in a world rigged with pitfalls. They will force the nation to produce more than it consumes, perhaps through stiff taxes and budget surpluses, exactly the opposite choices from the ones elders made in their own unraveling era youth. Under 13er leadership, America will concentrate on building infrastructure and institutions, not on cultural depth or spiritual fervor. Come the high, a stingier public treatment of old people will be taken for granted. Despite a rough and neglected elderhood, 13ers will find solace in seeing their children shoot past them in affluence and education. Third, the young adult heroes, energized by the success of collective action, now want to change society from the outside in. Of all today's generations, the millennials probably have the most at stake in the coming crisis. If it ends badly, they would bear the full burden of its consequence throughout their adult lives. Yet, if the crisis ends well, millennials will gain a triumphant reputation for virtue, valor, and competence. People of all ages will steer them vast fiscal rewards and build them grand monuments. Like the world-conquering GIs in midlife, millennials will feel intensely modern in science and taste. They will construct large new things, establish a powerful social regimen, and indulge their children. When a new awakening later erupts, the millennials will, for the first time, discover a generation that refuses to celebrate them, their own children, freshly come of age. Lastly, the child artists, credulous youths in a world of powerful adults, will learn to trust conventions and prepare for ways to help others. A positive ending to the crisis will craft the new silent into the romantics, technicians, and aesthetes of an exultant new order. Feeling the emotional strains of their cloistered childhood and post-heroic youth, they will sing plaintive songs and tell ironic jokes about the brittle inequities of the new order. If a prosperous new high thrusts mankind deeper into space, the new silent could well be the first to reach other planets in a rocket fleet launched by the next John Kennedys and piloted by the next Neil Armstrongs. And if the crisis ends in triumph, what will come of the splendid new victory generation born just after it ends? As children, they will be indulged. As youths, they will revolt against the elder-built world. In midlife, they will protect their children from civic decay. As elders, sometime around the year 2100, the gray champion will appear yet again among them. History is seasonal, but its outcomes are not foreordained. Much will depend on how tall we stand in the trials to come. But there is more to do than just wait for that time to come. The course of our national and personal destinies will depend in large measure on what we do now as a society and as individuals to prepare. Given the gravity of the coming secular winter, you may be asking, can anybody do anything about it? A belief in cyclical time teaches you not just to accept the rhythms of history, but to look for ways to make use of them, to fulfill your role in those rhythms as best you can. It is an antidote to fatalism. If you wish to get more out of life or nature, you have the power to do that, but it takes work. You and your society have the power to influence history, but that takes work too, and always your efforts must be appropriate for the time. As with life or nature, the proper plan for the saeculum is to move with, not against, the seasons. We should participate in seasonal activities by taking advantage of the current turning, avoid post-seasonal behavior by terminating habits that were appropriate for the prior turning but are not for the current one, and make pre-seasonal preparations by trying to anticipate the needs and opportunities of the next turning. To be seasonal, America should take maximum advantage of the current unraveling. The diversity and complexity of 1990s-era America are thrilling when intelligently explored. The popular culture, at its best, is outstandingly creative. New personal technologies are challenging, exciting, and broadly affordable, lending unprecedented access to every crevasse of human knowledge, culture, and experience. We should enjoy and harness all that while we can, because much of it will be less available or feel less pleasurable in the fourth turning. At the same time, there is plenty to guard against. Diversity is producing new racial enclaves. The pop culture at its worst is violent and debasing. New technologies are eroding traditional human interactions, manners, and civic duties. The gap between rich and poor is daunting. America consumes more than it produces and goes ever more deeply into debt. We should avoid and control these excesses now, while realizing that society will address them more fundamentally in the fourth turning. We can make the current turning into a splendid secular autumn, but we can't turn it into spring. We'd be foolish to try to eradicate all the vices of an unraveling while still in an unraveling. We just can't do it. To avoid being post-seasonal, America should stop awakening-era behavior. In the current unraveling era, many people have paid dearly for post-seasonal behavior. Gary Hart's political career ended over a dalliance far less serious than the Chappaquiddick incident that Ted Kennedy's career survived in 1969. Bob Packwood had to resign from the Senate when his critics applied unraveling-era standards to revelations about his awakening-era behavior. Joycelyn Elders lost her Surgeon Generalship for comments many in the media would have praised 2 decades earlier. Calvin Klein had to withdraw jeans ads, flaunting an adolescent sexuality that would have seemed tame in the 70s. The Clintons' 1994 proposal to create a vast new federal health care edifice conjured up Johnson's 1964 proposals for Medicare and Medicaid. LBJ's plans were seasonal and sailed through, but Clinton's were post-seasonal and crashed. To be pre-seasonal, America should prepare now for the fourth turning. Even when people do not think seasonally, an instinctive feel for the cyclicality of time can prompt valuable pre-crisis preparations. In the last third turning, amid the complexities of the 1910s and the circuses of the 1920s, the missionary generation launched pre-seasonal trends that greatly aided the nation in the ensuing Depression and war. Parents, teachers, and scoutmasters restored order to a child's world. Culture czars cleaned up Hollywood and baseball. Preachers of divergent faiths issued parallel missives against civic decay. Local officials tested new social programs. World War I aside, national officials avoided new debt. None of this was done explicitly to prepare for bad times, but it had that effect, much to America's later advantage. Pre-seasonality is as functional as post-seasonality is dysfunctional. We admire pre-seasonal purpose when we see it in people. Indeed, America's best-remembered presidents displayed this in deed or oratory before they were elected. The crisis-era steadfastness of Washington and Eisenhower foreshadowed the coming highs, making both generals enormously popular choices for presiding over those eras. In manner and morals, John Kennedy anticipated the consciousness revolution. Nearly alone amid the late awakening's nervous and hysterical clatter, Ronald Reagan had a feel for the self-assured and jaunty unraveling mood he would later personify. America's two most beloved national saviors each augured fourth turnings before the fourth turnings arrived: Lincoln in his Douglas debates, and FDR in his pre-New Deal lab work as governor of New York. Just as no single style of leadership or hero worship is suitable for every turning, neither do any of today's familiar political philosophies offer the right answer for every turning. Nearly all political philosophies wax and wane with the saeculum. In the current unraveling, pluralism and free markets are both very popular. The seasonal rhythm implies that the popularity of both is now cresting. Were America back in the high, pre-seasonal thinking would suggest pushing for more of both. Today, however, pre-seasonal thinking suggests preparing for less of both, since come the fourth turning, America will no longer be as hospitable to we-first lobbies and me-first free agents. As the saeculum turns, their day will ultimately come again, albeit not into the middle of the 21st century. Seasonal blindness afflicts proponents of countless well-known causes. Whether feminists or right-to-lifers, the ACLU or NRA, supply-siders or the civil rights establishment, single-issue champions persistently demand unilinear progress toward a fixed programmatic goal. In a seasonal world, such efforts lead to inevitable self-deception and frustration. In some eras, these causes take credit for progress that was mostly due to come anyway. In other eras, they despair over backsliding, which really isn't their fault either. Through the last three secula, most liberationist social causes, like feminism or civil rights, tend to seed in a high, blossom in an awakening, mature in an unraveling, and decay in a crisis. Yet today, many of their proponents keep struggling for post-seasonal goals. They seek more awakening-era passion in the midst of a gathering, unraveling-era cynicism. It is as though, by dint of sheer will, they could force tiger lilies to bloom in the November woods. Neither of the two major political parties has been adept at seasonalist thinking. The Republicans were worse at figuring out what the awakening required, the Democrats worse in the early unraveling years. With the fourth turning roughly a decade away, each party now has it half right. Democrats have seized the seculum's autumnal instinct to harvest. Republicans, the instinct to prune and scatter. Each party is usefully pressing for some pre-seasonal policies. Democrats wish to close the gap between rich and poor, reverse the decline of the middle class, and expand children's programs. While Republicans want to defund time-encrusted bureaucracies, restore an ethic of personal responsibility, and promote traditional virtues. Yet both parties are also harmfully post-seasonal. In their quest for an ever bigger harvest, Democrats want to remove sacrifice ever further from the public lexicon. They seek entitlements for every victim, including the entire middle class, without caring whether all this guaranteed consumption is sustainable. If Democrats get their way, they would impose huge debts and future taxes on millennial children. In their quest for ever more individualism, Republicans want to make public authority ever more dysfunctional. They seek to starve all government of revenue and are willing to shut down whole federal agencies to make their point. If Republicans get their way, they would prevent millennials from forging a positive bond with government and limit the public resources directed toward the care and schooling of the neediest children. Come the fourth turning, America will need both personal sacrifice and public authority. The saeculum will favor whichever party moves more quickly and persuasively toward a paradigm that accommodates both. Both parties should lend seasonality to their thinking. Democrats, a concept of civic duty that limits the harvest. Republicans, a concept of civic authority that limits the scattering. If they do not, the opportunity will arise for a third party to fill the void, after which one or both of today's two dominant parties could go the way of the Whigs. History warns that when a crisis catalyzes, a previously dominant political party or regime can find itself directly blamed for perceived mistakes that led to the national emergency. Whoever holds power when the fourth turning arrives could join the unlucky roster of the circa 1470 Lancastrians, circa 1570 Catholics, circa 1680 Stuarts, circa 1770 Tories, circa 1860 Democrats, and circa 1929 Republicans. That party could find itself out of power for a generation. Key persons associated with it could find themselves defamed, stigmatized, harassed, economically ruined, or even personally punished. While a crisis mood renders societies newly desperate, it also renders them newly capable, which is why a secular winner is to be welcomed as much as feared. As today's Americans look ahead, the challenge is to marshal the coming season's new public energies to achieve positive, not destructive, ends. The better we ready ourselves collectively, the more likely we will be not just to survive the crisis, but to apply its fury for good and humane purposes. Let's ask the authors, William Strauss and Neil Howe, what they think we should do to prepare for the fourth turning.
In general, we should simply apply the lessons of seasonality. Number one, stop being post-seasonal. In other words, move beyond the awakening-era public argument and high-risk personal behavior. Number two, enjoy what the current season has to offer. In a lot of ways, a third turning is a wonderful time with lots of opportunities.
Enjoy it while you can, because it won't last that much longer.
And, number three, we should be as pre-seasonal as we can. That means we'd better brace ourselves for the fourth turning.
Yes, but it's important to distinguish between things we can and can't do now, between actions that are possible in a third turning, and those that will simply have to wait until the crisis catalyzes.
And you expect that to happen in the middle of the next decade?
Yes, by the middle of the OOs, give or take a few years.
What's the single most important thing America can do to prepare for the fourth turning?
Simply put, we need to restore values in our civic life, every way we can.
In the fourth turning, when the community will again come first, civic virtues will be demanded and, if necessary, imposed with a vengeance. America's culture warriors can rest easy on that point. Speeches will become public sermons. Schools will become civic churches. Art will become motivational propaganda.
The big question is whether America's fourth-turning values consensus will be broad and solid enough to avoid a destructive polarization as our nation fights for its survival. For now, we need to get all sides of the culture wars to work together to elevate moral and cultural standards. That could be real hard given the present mood, but we need to try.
What we do now won't necessarily close down many third-turning carnivals, but it can serve two critical longer-term purposes: to help protect the world of childhood and to help reinfuse our institutions with a much-needed sense of public purpose.
A decadent culture is a seedbed for fascism.